Whatever became of One Man's Family. My name is Richard Lamparski, and my guest today, as you might guess from the introduction, One Man's Family, is a member of that cast. His name is Mr. Paige Gilman, and he's with us today all the way from Ojai, but this program is heard in Ojai, California. What are you doing out there, Mr. Gilman?
Well, that's where I live. I work in a newspaper in Ventura County.
We were going to begin this program with the theme, and I remember two themes, Patricia and the Destiny Waltz, but we couldn't get either one of them. I wish I could hum, I can't, for young people, so they might remember what the music was like. That show, One Man's Family, came from San Francisco, as I recall.
It originated in San Francisco. However, it moved to Los Angeles after about 5 years of operation in San Francisco. Since so many people thought the program was real, the National Broadcasting Company never went out of its way to call attention to the fact that it had moved to Hollywood, where so much of network radio had moved in the 30s. But we did move to Hollywood, and then when the program was identified, they would say this program comes to you from California rather than from Hollywood. It's surprising how real that program was to many people. In San Francisco, I'm told. In fact, my wife and my mother also have taken the sightseeing tour through Seacliff, San Francisco. And since there was no real house in Seacliff that the Barber family really lived in, it was up to the tour people to discover one. So they chose the one that they thought fitted the description the best. And they still, I understand, point out this house to visitors to San Francisco. This is where the Barber family lived.
Oh, but you're kidding. Well, people wouldn't take that seriously,
oh, yes,
though, would they?
Oh, yes. This program, among several in those days of the 30s, were intensely real to their listeners. And this is a very gratifying thing about it still today. Those who meet you understand, of course, that you are or were an actor and that it was a radio program written by someone and acted by someone, but still it was real to a surprising number of people.
Were you on the first broadcast?
Yes, I was, and I was on the last.
Do you remember the date of the first?
I only remember that it was in spring of 1932.
Well, I have it here in front of me. It was April 29th, 1932. Did we say you played Jack?
Yes,
all that time?
Perhaps. I think you did, yes.
Jack Barber.
Yes, I was a boy in high school when the program started, and I was a father of six children by the time it was completed.
You must have been a child actor because you're not that old now.
Yes, I started in radio at the age of nine back in 1927. And radio drama, of course, in those days was just beginning. And it was really only being done a few places in the United States. But fortunately, they were able to take me at that very tender age and teach me to become one.
I wonder if that holds the record, One Man's Family, beginning in 1932 and going until 1959. And that was uninterrupted, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. This is what you have to define. Amos and Andy had a longer period on the air if you include their TV time and if you include, or if you do not count the interruptions. But One Man's Family was continuous. It never went off the air during the summer, and it was 27 years of continuous broadcasting.
Yes, I do remember that because we usually went to a cottage for the summer or a farm. And although I must say my family didn't follow it that closely as others did, but I recall in cottages we would hear it, you know, at that particular time in the evening, Sunday evening, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Sunday evening, yes. You know, if we would go over to visit the kids across the road or the other side of the lake, they would be, their mothers would be playing One Man's Family on the air. And they always announced this program will not go off during the summer because most of them did, like most of the television.
Yes.
Most of the television shows today. How is it you're not acting anymore?
Well, I really think it was rather a tragedy as far as we ourselves were concerned. But the sponsors at one period, just before World War II, felt that it was best if we went on exclusive contract with them. This is fine from them, from their standpoint, but really for the actor's standpoint, it's very poor because he gets so stereotyped in one part. As a result, two things happened. First of all, the writer felt that he was getting quite stale doing just one program, Carlton Morse, who not only wrote but created the program. And secondly, the actors felt that it was quite difficult for them just to stick to one part. So the program I Love a Mystery was started for this specific reason. And Mike Raffetto, who played Paul, and Walter Patterson, who played Nicky, and Bart Yarbrough, who played Cliff, played the three characters of Jack, Doc, and Reggie on that I Love a Mystery. I understand, by the way, that that is now going on TV very shortly. In fact, it's being done in Hollywood right now.
Does Carlton E. Moss live in San Francisco?
No, he lives down the peninsula on what is called the Skyline Boulevard, and his home in that area above Redwood City is really the locale of the Sky Ranch, as it was called in One Man's Family.
That's right. That was the retreat, the
yes.
Sky Ranch.
Except that, of course, he doesn't raise blooded horses as Nicky was supposed to have. It isn't that kind of country. It's quite heavily redwooded, but the description of the climate and the location is certainly accurate. That is his home.
Did you ever work on One Man's Family, too?
You mean on I Love a Mystery?
I'm sorry, on I Love a Mystery.
Yes, not with a regular part. Whenever I was on, where I used to get killed rather quickly off again. But to go back to your question as to why I am no longer an actor, because of this exclusive contract, why I was young and as ambitious as I guess as one should be at that age, so I went to work in a newspaper, and I was a linotype operator, and in fact, I stayed as a linotype operator until One Man's Family went off the air in 1959, and then I switched over to the business side of a newspaper, and now I am assistant business manager of the newspaper in Ventura County.
I think that's interesting what you say about Carlton E. Moss creating I Love a Mystery because he felt so stymied, I guess, with One Man's Family, because a friend of mine used to say, I'm going back about 15 years when you were still on the air and I first began in radio, this was an executive with CBS, he said that Carlton E. Moss wrote I Love a Mystery to get all that sweetness and light out of the system that he put in One Man's Family.
That's a pretty good description. It is true, however, that Carlton Moss built his original reputation around mystery shows, and these actually antedate One Man's Family. And Mysteries by Moss, which went on at midnight, usually midnight Friday night or Saturday night, were intentionally put on at that late hour so that the young children would not be frightened by them. We've taken a different tack in radio and TV today. We put on the scary programs so the children will see them. But in those early days, we tried to avoid the child audience. And I used to work on very occasionally on one of Mr. Morse's Mysteries by Moss. But when I did so, when I wasn't working on it, I wasn't allowed to listen to it. I was too young.
What was the atmosphere like in the studio on the last broadcast?
Well, not quite as sad, perhaps, as you might think. Largely because in those days we were taping ahead of time, and when we did do the last broadcast, we still weren't sure about what the contract would be renewed again. NBC had decided, however, to kill all of its network drama shows and have gone into their present-day format. We felt it was rather sad because the program was a success financially. It had lots of sponsorship, but of course the pattern of listening was changing. There was quite an outcry from our listeners, but we ourselves, it wasn't such a big sad goodbye because we weren't sure about what we'd be back again in a couple of weeks doing it. So,
was Carlton E. Moss from a large family, or did he have a large family? How do you think he developed these characters?
Oh, very much so. He drew the idea of a family's interdependence from his own family. He was raised as a farm boy in the Sacramento Valley. And while he had, in a sense, escaped the quiet family life into the newspaper work and ultimately into writing, he always cherished that which it stood for and felt in the Depression days that he could really contribute something to social problems, if you want to put it that way. With this family approach. And the dedication of the program really had this in mind. As to the characters themselves, most of them are taken in part, well, the mother and the father are very definitely taken from his own mother and father, but the other people are pretty much taken from those who played the part, especially myself. The character of Paul, who, if there were a hero to One Man's Family, it would be the character Paul, was taken from two people, Mike Raffetto, who played the role, and was himself quite erudite and quite a scholar and had a gorgeous voice, and another individual named Bill Royal, who had been an ace in World War I, literally had been, and sort of a Douglas Fairbanks Jr. type. Well, more like senior than junior. If you recall the little tiny mustache and the swaggering manner that Douglas Fairbanks Sr. Portrayed. Well, this was Bill Royal, and Bill with his dashing nature and Mike with his quiet, scholarly nature were combined to make the character Paul.
You mentioned the Depression. As I remember, the Barber family was sort of upper middle class, weren't they? But Father Barber had a bit of money.
I think today we would call them upper middle class. I think in the 30s it depended pretty much on your own viewpoint. I think they were darn wealthy from the viewpoint of many others.
From my vantage point at that time, we consider them quite rich.
Yes. Well, I think that's really quite true. After all, he was a stockbroker wealthy enough to have retired at about the age of 50, and that's pretty well off.
Is that how old he was supposed to be, 50?
I believe so. There had to be a little juggling of age because the program was on for 27 years, and I would say roughly that, they never really pinned down an age for Father and Mother Barber. They had to stretch things quite a bit to make the oldest son a veteran of World War I, and the youngest son born at the end of World War I. This took a little doing, you see. So we never got down to specific ages. We just kept them kind of vague for that reason.
He always seemed older to me, you know, from his voice. He seemed to harumph an awful lot for someone just 50. And say, oh,
yes.
Fanny.
Yes, that was very much overdeveloped. But if you stop to realize, he was doing the same thing at age 50 as he was doing 27 years later. So, you know, with most of us, that's a characteristic I think we would develop as age came along. But with him, he apparently always had it.
Now, unfortunately, he and Mother Barber have died recently. Is that correct?
Yes, both in the last year. We had a wonderful party. This would be the original Mother Barber. She had never been an actress, really, until about a year before One Man's Family was started. She was actually a grandmother before the program started, and she started in a little theater in Berkeley, University of California, and was recommended to Mr. Morse for the part of the mother. But then, after a good number of years, she was a little tired and felt as if she would like to leave the program. So the last, I would say, 4 years or so, she was not on it. But, of course, she still was Mother Barber to all of us. So she had her 90th birthday early last year. And everybody came who could come. And it really was a tremendous party.
Were you there?
Oh, I was there. I wouldn't miss it, of course. Such a dear person. And during the day, she did get tired. Although I will say she started the day quite early, got up and cooked her famous lemon tarts, which were just mad about, all of us. And her cookies and so forth. And she was not giving the party, of course. It was given for her. But during the day, she tired a bit and had to go to bed and greet her final guests from bed. But after all, this is your 90th birthday party. How few of us... Well, we hope that all of us can reach that 90th birthday, but it really is a remarkable achievement. And it wasn't more than 6 weeks or so later that she just died very quietly in her sleep, which we were grateful for, because she's a lovely woman. And very typical of her as an individual. There was no ceremony, no flowers, no anything. She just wanted to say goodbye to her friends, and that was it. Some people may have been a little shocked that she wanted no services or anything, but this was very typical of the woman. Father Barber had died about 4 months after that. And this really makes only three who left the original cast. Bart Yarrow played the part of Cliff, and also, I hate to say this, but Bart probably had his greater fame not from One Man's Family, but from being Jack Webb's original partner in Dragnet, the old radio Dragnet, and the first couple of TV films they made were with Bart Yarbrough as Sergeant Friday's partner, and Bart died in 1952, so there's only those three that left the original cast.
As I recall, when Barton Yarbrough died, they wrote him out of the script by sending him someplace. To Scotland, that was
yes,
it.
I believe
yes.
So. This was a technique that Mr. Morse had to develop, really, during the war years. We didn't know from about 1941 on whether anybody might not have to leave the program in a hurry, even himself. And I was the only one who actually went, and he had to have a kind of an interesting technique with me. If you remember in those days, the OWI used to assign what we would today call the Advertising Council, but the OWI then kind of assigned various chores to different radio stations and also, of course, to all the print media, newspapers and magazines and so on, had to plug one thing or another every so often. Well, one time Mr. Morse had the assignment of plugging Marine enlistment. So he had Jack go roaring down to the Marine Corps and enlist in their reserve. That way he had an out. When I got called into service, why, Jack was all set. He'd just be called up in his Marine reserve unit. But when I went into the Army, and I started sending letters home, which Mr. Morse thought were too good to leave out, so he had to gradually switch Jack over from the Marines to the Army. So Jack went in on the Marine and came out on the Army.
Was one of you, this just occurs to me now as I'm listening to you, was one of you a flying tiger?
No, I don't recall the connection with flying tigers.
Did Paul fly?
Paul flew, but now it may be that during the war years he was doing something with flying
something
tigers.
Romantic, and I doubt it would be the Spanish Civil War. That would be too controversial.
Yeah, no, it may well be. Of course, you got to remember that those 3 or 4 years I was only in and out, so much of the detail of the script during the war years I'm not too familiar with, and it may be that he was in something of that nature. They certainly had to utilize his obvious. Or his fictional talents, put it that way, his obvious fictional talent. But in addition, you could hardly ignore what was going on in the world around you, so I suspect that may have been.
Now, you were at late Mother Barber's 90th birthday party, so you probably know what a lot of the cast are doing now. Could you tell us some of them?
Yes, of course, you'll have to speak a great deal about which cast. For example, of the original cast, Mother Barber and Father Barber have passed on. Paul is living in Italy right now. His daughter is a student. I believe she's in Rome, but I'm not sure. And then Hazel, who played, I'm lapsing into the character name, Bernice Berwin, who played Hazel. Her husband is an attorney in San Francisco, and she lives with him there. The original Claudia lives here in New York. Her husband is a magazine publisher. Kathleen Wilson was her name. And then Bart Yarbrough, of course, has passed on. Now, this is the original cast. But actually, when you get down to the very final cast, back in 1959, there were only two of us left out of the original seven. This was Tony Smythe, Father Barber, and myself. Hazel, we did not replace because Bernice left us really only in the last year or so, and we just kept avoiding seeing Hazel. She was just always around the corner. I think they would have made a decision sooner or later to replace her. I'm not sure. Claudia was played at the end by Barbara Fuller, who is today an actress in Hollywood, does a great deal of TV work. Clifford was never replaced, I guess that takes care of us, doesn't it? That gives us the original group. Of course, by the time the program closed after 27 years, I really have lost count how many grandchildren there were. I guess I could, if I had enough fingers and toes, I could probably do it. But Paul had an adopted daughter, Teddy, and Teddy ultimately was married. Hazel had twins
ran in that family, as I remember.
Yes, of course, this got to be, I'm afraid, something of a joke. Twins did run in the family. Claudia and Clifford were twins, and Hazel had twins. And then when Jack and Betty had already had three children, I'm convinced to this day that Carlton Morse meant this as something of a joke on the girl who played the part, because she was herself quite motherly and had a very large family. But anyway, Jack and Betty showed up with triplets, and I thought that was really overdoing it. The triplets, as a matter of fact, caused such a chore, and really getting three little girls whose voices would be similar yet dissimilar is so difficult that we never did use the triplets on the air.
You know, the programs I remember most of One Man's Family were the famous Christmas shows.
Oh, yeah.
With the bells. And everybody went off to get their gifts, and they had bells so you would know when they were coming back.
Yeah.
You probably remember it better than I did.
Oh, yes. It was a big tradition. And one of the two or three occasions that Mr. Morse used during a year to inject a little general philosophy, because he could do it in a format that was quite acceptable. One was the occasion where family unit by family unit, you went upstairs to get your presents and bring them down. And I believe this is what's actually done in Mr. Morse's own family. And the other occasion, of course, was what they called the burning of the leaves, where everybody gathered and raked leaves on the lawn and burned them. Of course, today you'd be contributing to smog, but in those days, well, it was quite acceptable.
Yes, and you couldn't get kids to rake leaves today.
if they
get a gardener. I was interested to see all the people who had been on One Man Summit at one time or another, and in parts, Loreen Tuttle and Hal Perry. And I must credit this book because it's been a great help to me. It's called Radio's Golden Age, and it's by Frank Buxton, that's television Frank Buxton, and Bill Owen, and it is published by Eastern Valley Press. I get books all the time, and usually I don't even read them because they're of no use to me. But this has the complete cast list and a lot of information on just about, I guess, all the more important radio shows. Now, you looked it over first. Was it quite accurate?
Yes, it seemed to be, and it was more accurate than I could possibly have remembered. One individual who played the part of Claudia for just a few weeks, I recalled, and yet it says exactly which weeks she played the part. It's amazing. They must have gone right to the bookkeeping departments to get some of these things.
I was amused by the one you found. You must tell the audience, Jill Oppenheim, was that the name?
Yes. One of the early girls who played Elizabeth Sharon Ann, that was the oldest daughter of Jack and Betty, was Jill Oppenheim. Well, Jill Oppenheim is today's Jill St. John. She's changed quite a bit. I'd love to see her again. How my daughter has changed.
Do you hear from them? I mean, do you exchange Christmas cards? Or do you visit each other at all?
Yes, quite a bit. The original cast of characters meets as often as we can. I know I like to visit them. Since several of them live in the Bay Area, I said Paul is living in Italy, but actually his home is in Berkeley, and Mr. Morse lives down the peninsula, and Bernice Berwin Hazel lives in Oakland. These three I see with some frequency, and then Claudia, who's here in New York, I will be seeing her while I am here. And I'm very good friends with the girl who played Betty later on, and her oldest son was born just a few days before my oldest son, so it has really been a very close relationship for many of us.
How did Mr. Morris and you and the cast take the Bob and Ray take off One Fellow's Family? Was that ever commented on?
Oh, yes, a little bit. After all, it was in fun, and we hardly felt that we were inviolate from someone's satire. we were amused by it, of course.
It was very funny.
Oh, surely.
Yeah. Mr. Morse was amused, too?
Oh, yes.
Did you have tender leaf tea all the way?
No. We started out on the West Coast with Wesson Oil and Snowdrift, which at that time was not a nationally distributed product. The product that took us to national distribution was one which did not last very long, called Kentucky Winter Cigarettes. We were grateful to them because they took us national, but our audience was just aghast at our being sponsored by a cigarette. And we were with them. It couldn't have been more than a couple of months. I'm surprised your book doesn't have that down. Having made that break, well, then we were very shortly picked up by Standard Brands and Tender Leaf Tea or the gelatin, so forth, were the products they used with us in particular. But strange to say, our longest sponsor, I really believe, was Miles Laboratories for one-a-day vitamins and so forth. And this, however, was in its later days, but I think if we added up those four major sponsors, I think that Miles was with us the longest, although I'm sure that, speaking of the golden peak years, if you want to, Standard Brands is the one that, of course, is best known.
Well, I thought of you all as receiving a lifetime supply of tea bags.
That would be nice.
Tender Leaf was the one I remember most. And then it switched from Sunday nights to 5 day a week there near the end, didn't it?
Yes, about 1949. In fact, actually the last 10 years, which is about a third of the program's life. Radio itself was changing, and a half-hour program was no longer really as acceptable as it had been. So we, too, changed to that 15-minute format.
Do you ever miss acting? I mean, how long has it been since you've been in a radio studio now?
Oh, well, I was in a TV studio working a show very similar to yours in Toronto last year. No, I don't miss it. After all, 32 years, that's long enough.
You mentioned the dedication a few minutes ago, and a lot of people remember. I'm getting this from the book because I couldn't recite it. This is the the way the program opened with Mr. Morse's dedication. Quote, "A one-man family is dedicated to the mothers and fathers of the younger generation and to their bewildered offspring," unquote.
That isn't quite accurate. It's bewildering.
Bewildering. Well, maybe,
yes.
I copied it down wrong.
Uh-huh.
But I'll, bewildering offspring.
This, well, I can remember very distinctly, having heard it for so many years.
The younger people I know today are, I think, bewildered about their parents more than bewildering.
Oh, that may be. I'm enjoying being a parent just as much as I enjoyed being a child.
Well, I want to thank my guest today, who is Mr. Paige Gilman, who was for so many years a member of the cast of one of the best-remembered and longest-running radio dramas in the history of the what we call the golden age of radio, One Man's Family. The first broadcast, as we say, was April 29th, 1932. Now, this would make Chapter 31 of Book 135 that we did today, as One Man's Family, and that would make, think of this, 3,258 episodes.
Oh, I can believe it. You should see the filed copies that Mr. Morse has. He's the only one who has the complete scripts, and it takes a barn, literally a barn. He has a barn. It's filled with the family scripts.
Does he have many of the recordings?
Not too many, no.
That's too bad. I'd love to hear some of those. I can still hear it. Funny. Thanks very much, Mr. Gilman.
It's my pleasure.